Hello, if this series is still running in half a century from now, I expect somebody will by then have picked the life of Lord Gnome, the semi-mythical newspaper magnate who, from behind the protective cover of his assistant E. Strobes, is the owner and publisher of that great satirical institution, Private Eye. Well, the man sitting opposite me for today's Great Lives is a corporeal manifestation of his lordship. He co-founded the Eye more than 40 years ago, and he edited it for many years, and nowadays he's at the helm of the Oldie magazine. He also finds the time to appear on comic, radio and TV shows and to write some thoroughly serious books, including Lives of John Stuart Collis and Malcolm Muggeridge. Great Lives welcomes Richard Ingrams. Richard, who have you chosen to nominate for greatness and why?
I've chosen G.K. Chesterton, who's always been a hero of mine, partly because he was somebody who was always proud to describe himself as a journalist. He was proud to write for what people talk of as the ordinary man. And it followed from that that he was a Democrat. He genuinely believed in the ordinary person as the best judge of everything. He was also a religious man in the best kind of sense, I think, in that he thought that religion was a natural thing for people and not the other way around. And another good reason for choosing Chesterton is I think that in contrast to a lot of his contemporaries like Shaw or Wells, an awful lot of what he wrote is still true and right.
Gilbert Keith Chesterton, he lived from 1874 to 1936, poet, novelist, journalist, defender of the Christian faith, the man who wrote this.
The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried.
And this.
Did you catch this man? Asked the colonel, frowning. Father Brown looked him full in his frowning face. Yes, he said. I caught him with an unseen hook and an invisible line which is long enough to let him wander to the ends of the world and still to bring him back with a twitch upon the thread.
Wonderful phrase that. Anthony Hyde reading an extract from one of Chesterton's superb Father Brown detective stories. Richard Ingrams, at what stage in your life did you discover Chesterton, and when you had discovered him, what did he do for you?
I was the great-nephew of Maurice Baring, who was a writer that I never met, but because he was a great friend of not only Chesterton but Belloc. In fact, there used to be in the National Portrait Gallery a wonderful portrait of the three of them. I should think it's been taken down now and replaced by a picture of Posh Spice or something like that. So I was brought up really in a house that had Baring's books. I never read any of Baring's books, I have to say, not very loyally. And Belloc, I never really got on with, but I read Chesterton when I was quite young, and I still read him occasionally when I need cheering up, I think.
Now, about 10 years ago, in an introduction to a reissue of Chesterton's autobiography, you wrote how persuasively reassuring he is to those of us brought up as Christians who doubt and dither about their beliefs. I think some people will be surprised to hear you saying that, both by the fact that such a satirical-minded person as you wants to be a Christian believer, and that Chesterton's persuasiveness is enough to get you back on course when you stray.
Well, I think it's a great myth that satirical people aren't religious. I mean, you've only got to think of somebody like Dean Swift. Belloc and Chesterton were Catholics, of course, as were Evelyn Waugh, Graham Greene, all sorts of people. Beechcomber, great satirist.
J.B. Morton.
He was a Catholic. Mm-hmm. So that the idea that religion and satire don't go together, I think, is profoundly wrong. I think what Chesterton does is to make you think that the world we live in is a very strange and extraordinary place, and that human beings are very strange, really, is the word he would use. And I think it's partly to do with the fact that Chesterton started life not as a writer, but as an artist. He was really a sort of caricaturist, rather like my friend Willie Rushton.
Well, we have an archive recording of Chesterton. It's a little indistinct, I'm afraid, but it's the man himself. He's talking here in 1933 to the Canadian Authors Association luncheon about the last time he talked to the same gathering, though on that occasion it was by mistake.
I didn't know what to do. I thought of trying to explain that I was a lecturer, but that wouldn't do because some of them had been to my lecture. Then I thought, could I say I was a journalist? But I was quite sure that would not go down. A pressman means a very different sort of person from me. One glance at me would show that I had never crashed through a skylight in order to interview a celebrity, that I had not slid through a door that was almost shut in my face by somebody who wanted to keep me out of his bedroom.
It's rather strange hearing this rather high, is it, rather precise voice coming out of that huge frame. But it's also interesting, I think, that you can get from that the precision with which he chooses his words, which is another attribute of Chesterton, I think.
Well, also with us to help us unreal Chesterton's life is Professor Dennis Conlon, who's chairman of the G.K. Chesterton Society. And, Dennis, I believe you were involved in a sort of tangential way in a recent attempt to have Chesterton made into a saint.
Yes, it's a strange story. A group of Chesterton enthusiasts were at Westminster Cathedral. I think they included the Argentinian ambassador. They suddenly decided what a spiffing idea it would be if we could canonise Chesterton. And being alongside Westminster House, round they went, and they had a word with Cardinal Basil Hume. He was somewhat taken aback and came up with an impossible demand. What were the three miracles?
Because a wannabe saint has to
to come up with three miracles. But I think, so far, we haven't managed this. And certainly Cardinal Hume and the present incumbent are still waiting for us to do so.
Richard Ingrams, do you want to see Saint Gilbert?
I don't think so, because I think he would have found it rather comical. And I'm sure he didn't think of himself as a saint. I don't think of him as a saint.
I was surprised to learn, Richard, that his father was an estate agent. And actually, you see the Chesterton surname all over Kensington still, don't you, on for sale.
It's the same firm, isn't it? It's still in existence.
His parents were free thinkers, and they didn't bring him up as a believer. But I think he was attracted by the Salvation Army in some way.
He was attracted by many things. Theosophy at one time, then the Salvation Army, and he wrote a couple of poems about them. After that, brief flirtation with the Presbyterians.
Richard Ingrams, did you shop around a bit as a child as far as religions were concerned?
No, I was brought up in a funny household, actually, with a Protestant father and a Catholic mother and one of four brothers, and two of us had to be Catholics and two Church of England.
Did this give you a kind of religious schizophrenia? Or?
Well, it was like living in Northern Ireland a bit.
Personal border. Chesterton went to St Paul's School in London, and he was not a success academically there. He described school as
being instructed by somebody I didn't know about something I didn't want to know.
Didn't we all feel that? And one of his teachers said,
if we opened your head, we should not find brain, but only a lump of white fat.
But he did, Dennis Conlon, enjoy one thing in school days, didn't he, which was debating.
Indeed. He founded what was called the JDC, the Junior Debating Club. They met regularly up till the 1950s.
Richard Ingrams, you were a very keen debater at Shrewsbury School, weren't you?
Well, not very keen. I never really liked debates. But I do remember putting down Paul Foot in a debate once. It was about whether the country gentleman should be preserved.
Well, I looked up your reports of your debates once when I was writing a book about you all. And you debated hourly and daily and almost every minute.
Well, maybe I did.
And it, well, obviously played some part in training your minds to be funny.
Well, as far as Chesterton was concerned, my relationship with Willie did kind of remind me a bit of his with E.C. Bentley. And
the inventor of the Clerihue.
The Clerihue, which they wrote when they were still schoolboys.
And this was a period of Chesterton's life when he was dabbling in spiritualism and the Ouija board, wasn't it?
So he says, and so people say. I have my doubts, personally. The messages that came through on the Ouija board, tonight there will be horrible revelations, seem to point a very firm finger of accusation in the direction of his younger brother, Cecil. The spelling mistakes made by the Ouija board also point in that direction, I think.
Richard, were you ever attracted by such things?
No, I have to say I never dabbled, partly for the reason that I think I might get too involved in it, because I believe that there is something going on there which probably we shouldn't be dabbling with.
Chesterton was rescued from the occult, partly by the woman he married, Frances Blogg, and he began to establish himself as a writer. His first published novel, is that right, Dennis, first published novel, was The Napoleon of Notting Hill?
Indeed it was, yes.
Which came out in 1904. And Chesterton gives a very entertaining account of how it all began.
I was broke, only 10 shillings in my pocket. Leaving my worried wife, I went down Fleet Street, got a shave, and then ordered for myself at the Cheshire Cheese an enormous luncheon of my favourite dishes and a bottle of wine. It took my all, but I could then go to my publishers fortified. I told them I wanted to write a book and outline the story, but I must have £20, I said, before I begin. They gave it.
Good for them. The Napoleon of Notting Hill is an extraordinary fantasy about that part of London declaring war on the rest of the capital to save itself from property developers. Dennis, in a sense, it's a prophetic book, isn't it?
It is a jocular nightmare. It's the story of a quaint little man who is totally insignificant, quite mad, and due to a quirk of the electoral system where they decide that the king will be elected with full powers, he wins the lottery, and he becomes king. And he's able to put all his rather quirky little ideas into practice, and he founds what is a medieval society. He makes everybody dress up, and every borough of London must wear its own medieval uniform.
Richard, it's a book I always think I ought to like, and I always get a bit stuck in it. Do you like the Napoleon of Notting Hill?
I'm sympathetic to that view, Humphrey. I think it is interesting, though, that what I was saying about Chesterton being contemporary is that the story, as Dennis says, is about these little shopkeepers who are threatened by a big development.
Small is beautiful.
Small is beautiful. But that's a very Chestertonian theme, that, and it is there in that book.
Now, I have no problems reading Chesterton's other famous novel, The Man Who Was Thursday, which followed the Napoleon of Notting Hill by about, what, 4 years later, was it?
4 years later.
Richard, can you describe this book?
No, I think Dennis should describe
it. Too difficult, right. It is a very hard book to describe, isn't it?
Well, funny enough, it was an idea that, I don't know whether he got it from him, but Flaubert said, in every revolutionary there is a policeman. And that's the story of the book, isn't it? That there are these anarchists who are plotting to overthrow the whole system.
All of whom, reveal, are in fact policemen.
Yes.
Or are they? Because it doesn't stop there, does it? It's boxes within boxes. Terry Pratchett loves it, and he describes its theme as being both sides are actually the same side. And he says this has been the driving idea of half the spy novels ever written.
That's absolutely right.
Yes. It's also almost the only novel I know in which God appears as a character, and a comic one at that.
What am I? Roared the President, and he rose slowly to an incredible height, like some enormous wave about to arch over them and break. You want to know what I am, do you? Bull, you are a man of science. Grub in the roots of those trees and find out the truth about them. Syme, you are a poet. Stare at those morning clouds. But I tell you this, that you will have found out the truth of the last tree and the topmost cloud before you find the truth about me. You will understand the sea, and I shall still be a riddle. You shall know what the stars are and not know what I am. Since the beginning of the world, all men have hunted me like a wolf, kings and sages and poets and lawgivers, all the churches and all the philosophies. But I have never been caught yet, and the skies will fall in the time I turn to bay. I have given them a good run for their money, and I will now. Before one of them could move, the monstrous man had swung himself like some huge orangutan over the balustrade of the balcony. Yet before he dropped, he pulled himself up again as on a horizontal bar, and thrusting his great chin over the edge of the balcony, said solemnly, "There's one thing I'll tell you, though, about who I am. I am the man in the dark room who made you all policemen."
Wonderful. The apotheosis of the mysterious Sunday in G.K. Chesterton's The Man Who Was Thursday. You're listening to Great Lives on BBC Radio 4. We're discussing Chesterton with Richard Ingrams and Dennis Conlon. Richard, the appearance of Sunday in that marvellous passage is a bit like Chesterton himself, isn't it?
Yes. I've always thought that Chesterton is actually also Father Brown, although Father Brown is a little insignificant man, and Chesterton, as you say, is large and bouncy. But people thought of him as rather an absurd figure. And I think that was the public impression of Chesterton, really, but partly because he dressed up in comic hats and cloaks and carried a sword stick, and he is actually the man who gets it right.
He's always struck me as being a carefully contrived figure, like, say, Oscar Wilde or his friend George Bernard Shaw.
I think that's right, but I think the general view of Chesterton was to underestimate him and to think that he was a man, well, with his head in the clouds, who didn't really know what was going on.
Dean Inge said he was a fat buffoon who crucified truth upside down. And he certainly did use the paradox. He probably overused the paradox at times. But the public image of the fat man in the Orson Welles sherry advert kit with the black cloak and the brigand's hat was a late addition, I think. He had been a very tall, thin gentleman until about 1904. It was only after that that he developed some kind of dropsy and put on the weight. And then he projected this new image, which has been so associated with him that nobody can think of any other figure now.
Richard mentions Father Brown, and we come now to that great achievement of Chesterton's, creating the priest detective. The first Father Brown story appeared in 1910, 2 years after The Man Who Was Thursday was published. Father Brown, Dennis, was based on a real priest who helped to convert Chesterton to Roman Catholicism.
Yes, Father O'Connor, who had a parish up in Heckmondwight in Yorkshire.
And it was love at first sight.
Well, I'm not sure. Chesterton said they went out for a walk, and he rather despised this little priest and couldn't quite see that he would have a grasp of the world. But talking as they walked across from Keighley to Ilkley over the moors, Father O'Connor, who became Father Brown, instructed him in the fact that any priest, certainly a Roman Catholic one, who is every Saturday sitting in a confession, will learn more about the foibles of the human race than any other person on God's earth.
Richard, you're nodding vigorously at this.
Well, yes, and it reminds me of the way, you know, people criticise the Pope nowadays for his rulings about things to do with sex and the family and so forth, saying, well, how can a man who's no experience of marriage know anything about this subject? And that's obvious. I mean, Dennis has given the answer to that. It's quite obviously true.
Well, having been converted by Father Brown, here is Chesterton's description of how he converted the priest into one of the world's most famous detectives.
There sprang up in my mind the vague idea of constructing a comedy in which a priest should appear to know nothing and, in fact, know more about crime than the criminals. I afterwards summed up the special idea in the story called The Blue Cross, otherwise very slight and improbable, and continued it through the interminable series of tales with which I have afflicted the world. In short, I permitted myself the grave liberty of taking my friend and knocking him about, beating his hat and umbrella shapeless, untidying his clothes, punching his intelligent countenance into a condition of pudding-faced fatuity, and generally disguising Father O'Connor as Father Brown.
Well, now, we were looking for an excerpt from a good dramatisation of the Father Brown stories to put in this programme, and, of course, there isn't one, because, Dennis, they haven't been done on television. This is almost beyond belief, isn't it?
It is to me. There have been film versions, going all the way back to 1934. Later on, of course, there was the famous version in the 1950s with Alec Guinness as Father Brown, and that had a terrific effect on Alec Guinness's life and caused him, oddly enough, to convert to Catholicism.
Richard, did you see the Guinness Father Brown film?
I did, but I'm so long ago, I can't remember. But I think the trouble with the Father Brown stories is that they're not at all realistic in the way that a lot of detective stories are. I don't think they lend themselves to filming or anything.
I suppose it's true that the crisis or the kind of centre point in each of them, Dennis, tends to be rather metaphysical, the fact that X equals Y. It's a paradox being proved by Chesterton rather than identifying a flesh-and-blood murderer sometimes.
These are closed-box mysteries, but the plot has been lifted on numerous occasions. Agatha Christie, who was a friend of Chesterton's, and Dorothy Sayers both lifted his plots. And in recent...
I mean, he said the plot's lifted from him.
From him,
not
yes.
By him.
Not by him. Right. No, they've taken his plot and reused it, and it's still happening.
Don't tell us who you think it is now, because we'll have a libel suit on our hands. But
well, if you look carefully at some of the more colourful and metaphysical series on television at the moment, I think you will be able to go to a Father Brown story and say, gosh, in 1912, Chesterton had this story about a corpse in the middle of a field of snow with no footprints, and
Willie Rushton could have played the part, couldn't he?
Well, I don't think so, no, because he's too flamboyant.
He could have played Chesterton.
Anthony, somebody to be obscure.
Anthony Hyde, our reader, I'm sure has views.
Like a lot of actors, I'm pretty hopeless at actors, but I think Alec Guinness would take a lot of beating. I know he's not contemporary, and I still think we'd need to dig in the occult. My other vote would go to Donald Pleasance, a gnome-like quality. Mm. That's what I think it needs.
Well, not long after Chesterton had begun to write the Father Brown stories, he had a mysterious breakdown. What's all this about, Dennis?
I think it wasn't so much a breakdown as an illness. I've already referred to the fact that he put on a great deal of weight due to dropsy. I think this just snowballed, and by 1914, he was well over 300 pounds in weight. Now, a little boy in Belgium was evacuated to Beaconsfield and lived next door to the Chestertons. He later became the famous painter Baron Opsomer, but he left a record of living next door to the Chestertons, liking the fat gentleman, and the fat gentleman liked the little boy and used to ask him in.
Sounds a bit sinister.
It would be today, but let's face it, any fat gentleman who plays with a little boy...
But it does raise the question about Chesterton's own marriage. I mean, they had no children. Do you think it was a sexually compatible relationship?
She had an operation in order to have children. That implies that they had tried to have children and didn't. Now, beyond that, you know, my foot wasn't in the door as they closed the door on their own bedroom, so I would hesitate to comment. He certainly loved his wife. He'd had relationships with other girls before he met Frances.
Physical relationships?
Oh, heavens no, this was the 1890s. I suspect not. It wasn't impossible, but he was a rather tall, handsome, and very thin gentleman. So, I think he attracted young ladies.
Let's turn to tall, handsome Richard Ingrams. Do you have views on Chesterton's private life?
Well, all I was going to say, Humphrey, was that I knew very well someone who sat on Chesterton's knee when he was a little boy. That was Nicholas Bentley. He was Chesterton's godson, and he was the son of E.C. Bentley, who was Chesterton's great friend.
And he drew wonderful illustrations for Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats.
Indeed. He described how he was inspired to become an artist by sitting on Chesterton's knee, and he would spread out huge sheets of brown wrapping paper, and he would fish out chalks out of his pocket.
This is
coloured chalks, Chesterton. Mm. And he would draw faces and characters all over this brown paper. And Nick was so inspired by this that he determined to be an artist himself.
Wonderful.
And he ended up, as you know, illustrating Auburn War in private.
Oh, yes, of course. He was the Auburn War's diary.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I think it's time we had more of the man himself, Chesterton, giving a radio talk in 1936 about eating beef with spices. It typically of him seems rather inane, but actually there's lots of solid common sense there.
But while I should resist the suggestion that we must eat beef without mustard, I do recognise that there is now a more subtle danger, that men may want to eat mustard without beef. I mean that they may lose their appetite for beef and bread and cheese, and depend entirely on spices and condiments. I myself have even been blamed for defending the spices of life against what was called the simple life. I have been blamed for making myself a champion of beer and Skittles. Fortunately, if I was a champion of Skittles, there was never any danger of my being a champion at Skittles. Somehow I never could aim at Skittles with that precision with which I could aim at beer. But I have played ordinary games like Skittles, always badly. I have even played golf in Scotland before Arthur Balfour brought it to England, and it became a fashion and then a religion.
Typical chunk of provocative Chesterton. Richard Ingrams, what was all that about, do you think?
I'm not absolutely sure. But it did remind me of what he said. One of his sayings, I think, was that if a thing's worth doing, it's worth doing badly, which, again, I think is a perfectly obvious remark.
We've picked up his witticisms and his fondness for paradoxes and everything else. We haven't talked at all about his journalism, and I think you feel his journalism has been valuable for you.
Well, his journalism consisted, I think, in what you don't get in journalism nowadays, which was sort of essays, pieces of about 2,000 words on any topic that came to mind, losing your hat, spectacles.
Miles Kington type pieces.
Yes, I suppose Miles is one of the few people who can do that sort of thing. But it's not done nowadays, is it, to write an essay, really, in a newspaper?
He has been accused of anti-Semitism, but then so have you, Richard, sometimes, haven't you?
Well, it's very hard not to be accused of anti-Semitism these days. If you dare to mention even Israel, if you mention Mr. Sharon, you're definitely an anti-Semite.
Dennis, Chesterton is anti-Semitic?
Possibly guilty as charged, but with extenuating circumstances.
Which were?
In the sense that the Chesterton Society has a vice president who happens to be Gerald Kaufman, who in turn thinks Chesterton was anti-Semitic, but is still prepared to be our vice president, because he likes Chesterton.
He would say such things as, you know, I'm a Zionist, I support them, but I want them all to go home to Palestine or to dress up in Jewish garb. Is that right?
He didn't quite put it like that. He wanted everybody to dress up in colourful garb, let's put it like that. He did say that he thought that the Jewish community should have its own national homeland, but the ones he criticised most were the non-Orthodox. And often the man who was being criticised was in religion a Catholic.
Clearly very complicated. Richard Ingrams, would you like to have known Chesterton?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I think he does remind me a bit of Dr. Johnson Chesterton,
Yeah. If
you're talking about a great man. And what he has in common with Johnson is that he's very wise. He makes all kinds of comments about all kinds of things, and he gives you an insight into, well, life in general.
Would you like to have been more like him? Has he actually been a model for your own behaviour and personality?
Absolutely not, no. I'm afraid to say I don't live up to that. I think, going back to the question of whether he was a saint or not, perhaps he wasn't a saint, but he had a great sort of innocence about him. He knew things, but he knew them in a kind of weird, instinctive way. Somebody said about Goethe that he knew all along, and I think that was true of Chesterton, that he understood what it was all about without having actually experienced very much.
Richard Ingrams, thank you very much for choosing G.K. Chesterton as your great life, also to Professor Dennis Conlon of the Chesterton Society, and to reader Anthony Hyde, who has the last Chestertonian word.
Before the Roman came to Rye, or out to Severn strode, the rolling English drunkard made the rolling English road. A reeling road, a rolling road that rambles round the shire, and after him the parson ran, the sexton and the squire. A merry road, a mazy road, and such as we did tread, the night we went to Birmingham by way of Beachy Head.